Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back to part two of our little show. We had a little trouble just kind of connecting up here, but now we're all ready to go. And so we're going to spend the next 90 minutes. I'm going to spend the next 90 minutes, if I can say it, with an interesting fellow. His name is John Remington Graham. He started with philosophy way back, University of Minnesota, admitted to the bar of the Minnesota Supreme Court in 67, and he was a prosecutor for a very long time and an attorney for about 50 years, prosecutor in Minnesota, or public defender for 4 years or so. He was a founding professor teaching common law, pleading judicial writs and remedies, American constitutional law, admiralty, copyrights, all kinds of things. Minnesota is where he spent a lot of his time, but it's been a long career. He has many publishing credits, including the book that we talked to Jack Remington Graham about several months ago, Blood Money and the History of the Federal Reserve and Civil War. And that's quite an interesting interview that you can look on One Radio Network. Mr. Graham said that after being on the bar in Minnesota, bar of the Minnesota Supreme Court, after more than 50 years, he learned more than he would like to know about the cocaine business and other things up there, and he thus moved to Canada. Mr. Graham, that would be a whole show on its own that we ever talk about that someday. But
yeah, it's been a pretty interesting career.
Oh, good for you. But today...
You get all the facts right, but you were generally right.
I was pretty close. Well, I just got the bio about 2 minutes ago. I couldn't find your bio. Good morning to you, sir. So you live up in Canada, and we're going to talk about the history of the Revolutionary War and also some of your thoughts and opinions on what's going on with taking down some of these statues today, and you have some real opinions about that. So we're going to get to it all. We'll spend the next 90 minutes doing it. Let me start like this. So Saturday would be, almost a 250th anniversary. They call it the birth of this country. I guess it's the day they signed the Constitution, or close.
They signed the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, they signed the Declaration of Independence. Yeah, thank you.
In the Second Continental Congress.
Uh-huh. What do you think would be, in your opinion, after all these years of research, Jack Graham, of what would be the biggest misconception that our listeners and Americans have about the Revolutionary War?
Well, we were all taught that the war was about George III. Taxes, tea, and George III.
Yes.
Which is just a slogan like liberté, égalité, fraternité. For the French Revolution had nothing to do with what was really going on. The American Revolution was probably a revolution without cause. The British were a very good colonial power for the Americans, and they did not abuse us at all. There was only a three-penny tax on tea that was without consent of local legislatures, and so that really wasn't a cause. I mean, three-penny tax on tea is going to cause a revolution. And George III was a very conscientious king, a very good king, and the problem that caused the American Revolution is quite different than what we suppose. It was caused by legislation, first the Navigation Acts, which effectively required the American colonies to carry on their trade with the mother country to keep the British Empire in good condition. And the second was the Currency Acts, which limited legal tender currency to gold and silver coin. The colonies didn't have any deposits of gold and silver. They had to trade with the mother country, and because they were underdeveloped at the time, as colonies always are, there was an unfavorable balance of trade. And so they were always short of money. And the colonies then began to experiment with paper money. And the best system of paper money that was developed was in Pennsylvania. And it was a system that was based on land mortgages. It was paper currency, but disciplined by land mortgages. Mm-hmm. And it was a very successful system of currency.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean...
They were called land banks, right, Mr. Graham? Land banks?
No, that's something else.
Something else, okay.
That was more in our time. But the government of Pennsylvania created money and lent it into circulation in consideration of land mortgages.
Okay.
And that kept their currency... limited to a prudent extent, yet enabled them to have a domestic currency that was sufficient to prime their economy. Philadelphia became the second city of the British Empire. It was a very prosperous city, and Pennsylvania became very prosperous. Benjamin Franklin tried to get the British Parliament to adopt that kind of currency system for all of the American colonies. It didn't work, and consequently, there was an undersupply of currency in the colonies, and that damaged the economy, which also injured American enthusiasm for the British Empire, which was really a very good thing for the Americans at that time.
I see. So let's pick that apart. When you say, Mr. Graham, currency, could that mean paper representing gold and silver, or were to be just
paper,
gold and silver?
Paper representing gold.
Gold and silver. In Pennsylvania...
It was paper money, but disciplined by land banks.
Land banks.
By land mortgages.
Okay. So were these called dollars in those days?
Yes, they were. They were called dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes some colonies use the English terms... shillings and pounds, but that really is beside the point. The you had to have enough domestic currency, which could be paper money, to prime the economy, and you'd have to have paper money to take to fill a void of currency caused by the fact that the British colonies or the English colonies in America were always bought more than they could sell to England.
Mm-hmm. So, are you saying then that all of those things that are listed on the Declaration of Independence, George did this, George did that, some of those are...
Those are just excuses for a revolution.
Oh, excuses. But wouldn't the whole money thing and just being owned by somebody else be good enough excuse to want to be free?
Well, it might be a good enough excuse to want to be free, but not to wage a revolution. We needed England at that time.
Huh.
And it was a good thing for England, and it was a good thing. But what was bad was that the Currency Acts prohibited us from issuing paper money, so we have enough money disciplined by land mortgages to prime the colonial economy.
Yes.
Now that was the reason. That really was an irritation, and it's what caused the antagonisms between the English colonies and England.
Yes.
But it was nothing to do with taxes.
Taxes. So that's just something they teach in public schools.
That's just something they teach in public schools,
right,
and
right.
It was an excuse to make a revolution. You know, they didn't like England because England was limiting their supply of currency or money, paper money at the local level, which was needed to prime their economy. And England wasn't allowing that. And so they had to come up with an excuse for a revolution. Taxes, tea, and George III was what their excuse.
I see. So in your opinion, though, as an attorney or looking at it, wouldn't just the idea that they're limiting your ability to live and money and prosper and grow, that'd be reason enough, wouldn't it?
Well, it was. That was the cause.
That was the cause. But you're still saying that you don't think that I guess I don't understand your argument. Your argument is they lied about the reason.
All right.
Taxes,
tea, and George III is just a slogan.
I see. Well, maybe
the
that's...
The lack of currency was the reason.
Was the reason.
The revolution.
Yeah. Well, so the Currency Act said what? Why would George and the boys over there do that if they wanted their people to keep stay with them.
It was a problem, as a people have never really understood the problem of money.
Oh.
And it was thought that gold and silver coin was necessary to keep money supply under control.
Mm-hmm.
So they naturally passed laws that prohibited paper currency. It might have been due to the influence of the East India Company, which was in that day the equivalent of Bill Gates and the Bilderberg Group today. But they, in any event, we had this legislation that limited the currency in the colonies, and that was the real cause of the revolution. But Benjamin Franklin tried to help the England to resolve that, but it was a problem in which he was not heard because not a lot of people understood. I mean,
they just didn't understand.
Ever heard that the cause of the American Revolution was an undersupply of currency caused by the Currency Acts of 1754 and 1763? No, you never heard that before. And that's because what you heard was taxes, tea, and George III. And like every other American, you believed it, and I believed it too, until I began to study them.
You're right. Right. Yeah.
We should really understand, but what it really does is to explain the importance of the money question.
Yeah.
Who controls the money, and how should it be disciplined, and so on?
Yeah, so that would take us right here. If we want to move forward 250 years, the Federal Reserve Bank is still controlling the money, and not we, the people, or the Treasury.
Well, this is what I wrote about in my monograph, Blood Money, the Civil War and the Federal Reserve. You see, the Federal Reserve came about in this way. During the 1850s, large banking houses in London, Paris, Boston, New York, and Philadelphia agitated the ill feeling between the North and the South. And that eventually led to a secession of the southern states. The big banking houses in Europe and North America which agitated the war also financed it. And the South had no comparable financing, and that's why they lost the war. And in part of the consideration for financing the war was not only war bonds that paid interest, but the fact that the war bonds were an obligatory capital basis of a new and dominant system of banking and currency established under the National Bank Act of 1864, which established a banking cartel on Wall Street. These were the central banks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the central banks were finally legalized under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913,
mm-hmm.
many amendments. That banking cartel is a private banking cartel.
Yes, sir.
Private banking cartel controls our money and credit. And they also control the major news media in the United States.
Yes, sir.
And so when they try to blame the Civil War on the South and slavery and all that, they're just covering up the fact that the real problem that caused the Civil War in the first place was a banking cartel that wanted a war so they could finance it and gain control over money and credit.
Hmm. Well, how do you suppose it happened that the Currency Act, as you argue, of 1864 got wiped out? National Bank Act. But let's go back to the Revolutionary War of the Currency.
So those are called the Currency Acts.
The Currency Acts, yes, sir. How do you suppose that they got erased and never made it into the lexicon of American, that's the reason for the revolution?
Well, the private masters of money do not want the general public to understand the importance of the power to create and annul money.
Yes.
And because that only because the only reason why the banking cartel on Wall Street is so successful is that they control the major news media, of which the flagship is the New York Times.
Yes, sir.
And their associates throughout the country.
Hmm.
And I mean, I found this out when I was graduating from law school and getting ready to sign up for OCS in the Navy or the Marines or the Army. And then I found out that the war was that I had learned about in the newspapers was not the real thing. The war was an attempt by the people who had engineered the death of Kennedy to get us into a war, which was very ill-advised. We couldn't win that war.
Yes, sir. How did you find that out back then?
Well, I when I was graduating from law school, I picked up a book, a documentary by Marvin Gettleman, who taught at CCNY at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a compendium of primary sources, so it was self-authenticating to a large. And I found out that everything we had been told about the Vietnam War was a lie. So I got out of law school, and once admitted to the bar, I was defending young men who refused to be drafted.
Uh-huh.
I had very respectable argument that was used by the Hartford Convention to stop in New England to stop the War of 1812, and it reached its zenith in a decision of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1863, declaring drafted armies unconstitutional. And it was a very learned, I don't want to get into that whole argument, because it would take a long time to explain it, but
mm-hmm.
it was a very respectable, all of my clients were eventually pardoned or acquitted, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and then I went on to teaching and so on, and that was another phase of my career.
Yes, sir. So I wonder, we've often heard from attorneys, Jack Remington Graham, that
Graham or John Remington Graham.
Okay. Oh, I see. You use both. That's where I got confused. John Remington Graham. So I've often heard that if you're a member of the bar and you really get kind of, let's say, adventurous and out of the box like you did with the draft thing, that you're on thin ice a bit.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Yeah. Talk a bit about that. That's fascinating.
Well, when I was practicing law, in private practice after my time teaching, I brought a civil rights suit against the local county attorney, and there was a fix in the case, and it had been arranged at a bar association Christmas party.
A fix,
that is, the result was predetermined by bigwigs in the legal system.
Yeah.
And so when I found out about the conversation in which all this was occurred, I reported, and that led to I was suspended from the practice of law for 60 days.
Really?
And it was, you know, and that was pretty much the end of my reputation. But a newspaper, what happened was there was a deposition taken by the director of professional responsibility of a key witness to the conversation at the Bar Association Christmas party.
Hmm.
That evidence was hidden by the Minnesota Supreme Court in disciplining me. When the deposition was revealed by a veteran journalist, the people of my county put my name on the ballot and elected me county attorney.
Oh.
So I mean, that was a very unusual situation. I mean, I mean, talk about the 91st Psalm, you know. I mean, holy smokes!
Right.
And that's how I became a public prosecutor. I was a defense lawyer, and I made a number of changes. And while I was county attorney, I found out that the sheriff in my county was in the cocaine business, and the chief of police was in the cocaine business. A majority of the board of commissioners for the county were in the cocaine business.
Wow.
And I finally realized that I had to get out, so I did.
Mm-hmm. It was too big of a deal to put your arms around to try to expose all that?
Well, if I had tried to, I would have been shot.
Yeah, wow, really.
So I just, my wife is French-Canadian, and mm-hmm. we came to Canada after that, my time as public prosecutor.
We've heard over the years that this cocaine connection, of course, with Mena, Arkansas, and Clinton, and Afghanistan, and you know,
yes,
the Contra and all of that stuff, it was really, you think that's still going on today?
Yeah, I believe so, yes. I mean, I think it's, if it isn't going on in Mena, Arkansas, it's going on somewhere else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I mean, one reason why Trump is trying to close the border with Mexico and with outside of the United States is to stop the importation of cocaine.
Ah. But wouldn't it be fair to say that no matter what, these people, whoever they are going to get this stuff in there some way?
Well, that's they're going to try. They're going to try. If you have a president who is aware of this, he will be constantly working on preventing importation through the border. He'll tighten the border, and that's one reason. Trump is trying to close the border with him and legalize immigration to prevent importation of illegal drugs into the United States. That's one of the problems that has always existed. It will always exist, and you're not going to prevent it completely, but you can limit it. But at least you have to be aware of the problem in order to limit it.
Yes, sir.
And of course, the Democrats want no borders, which is just means that we'll have no end of criminals. And
why would the political left be more interested in open borders, in your opinion?
Well, the reason is that at the present time they're financed by the Bilderberg Group, which wants to destroy borders of nation states. The reason why they hate Trump is, you know, for all the reasons they've come up with, are just pretext. It's like taxes to you, George III, just an excuse. What they don't like Trump about is he wants to establish strong nation states, which is and then build a federal government upon strong nation states for world government. The Bilderberg Group wants an EU-style world government. So they are trying to hate. They hate Trump, and they're coming up with all kinds of reasons to blacken his name, and maybe they will succeed. Who knows?
Sure.
I mean, we hope it doesn't. I hope it doesn't, because I think strong nation states is the way of the future.
So can we call
when you take a look at this, a private group, mm-hmm. the Bilderberg Group, they want to control banking currency throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They want to be the private interests who control banking and currency throughout the world. So they're doing everything they can to darken the good name of any president, including Trump, who wants strong nation states.
Do you think that
that's what it's all about? I mean, don't believe all this other stuff. The big issue is either we're going to have an EU-style world government, new world order, and banking and currency, or we're going to have strong nation states. And Trump wants strong nation states, and so they're trying to destroy them, that's all.
How,
and they'll come up with any excuse that they can.
And these people, how have they have never tried to control the political right?
Well, I don't
In other words, say if you call them the globalists or the Bilderberg crowd and the bankers, they must have influence on the political right as well.
Oh, they do, but right now they're financing the left.
Okay, but they'll change if they.
That's why they have a bad incident in Minneapolis, and 6 days of burning hundreds of buildings,
mm-hmm.
and then the governor of Virginia orders the taking down of the statue of General Lee, who, you know, Black Lives Matter, abolish the police. That's to destabilize the United States, which is one of their objectives.
Destabilization.
Of the United States. Yeah, well, we can't, if we have a situation like Minneapolis and Seattle throughout the United States, then the United States won't be a significant player in world affairs anymore.
Hmm. John Remington Graham, Patrick Timpone. Stay right there. We have lots to talk about this morning. What fun. I love talking about these kinds of things. Hope you're enjoying it as much as we are. Please join the conversation, question or a comment, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. You can also use the telephone, 888-663-6386. 888-663-6386. Back with Mr. Graham in just a moment, and hope to get some good questions and input from you as well, because I have a lot of questions. And as you can hear with this gentleman, who attorney for 50 years and studying this stuff, he has some definite opinions and research that are curious to talk about. I don't know if you've done any curiosity scrolling around and clicking on Shen Blossom, but it's a great company that we know, Brandon Amalani. Just a very interesting man. We met Brandon maybe 12 years ago when he was working for Daniel Vitalis. And he was helping Daniel to put together new products. And he's just really good at it. I mean, he's just really good at it. And so he started his own company some years ago. And it's called Shen Blossom. And if you go on there through our website, you're going to find some products and interesting things to look at that you'll just be quite amazed, I think, at the ingredients alone. I mean, if you just go into like all products and the rare herbs, let me click on that now, you'll see things like a blood purifier, a Rise Male Potency Formula, a Jing Formula, Beauty Jing Formula, Ho Shu Wu Formula, Turmeric Formula, Potency Collagen Vitamin C from Food, a Longevity Tonic. And these are all so carefully and handcrafted that you'll say, whoa, I just can't believe that he does this kind of, because you can read the description, read the content, you know, the ingredient label, and you'll see real quickly how much care and time that goes into this. He was telling us that in the Ho Shi Wu, they think they have to go about 21 days just to make this product, and they use organic sake and these kinds of things, and they're very careful not to use stuff that they're just not good for your body. It's just quite a fascinating company to have this kind of quality. Now, these products are going to cost you a little bit more than if you just go on Amazon and buy some Ho Shi Wu. We don't know who the people are or how they make it or anything, but if you're going to spend your money, you go a little bit further, go first class, and know that you're going to get something that'll really work for you and your body could possibly love. These are products that are just top of the line. Brandon's going to come on in 2 or 3 weeks to talk about his whole Chinese medicine and these products. It's called Shen Blossom, OneRadioNetwork.com. Did you know the AquaCure Brown's Gas Machine reduces oxidative stress?
Hydrogen is the world's best antioxidant by a long shot.
Hmm.
First of all, it's 700 times smaller than something like CoQ10, 400 times smaller than vitamin C, things like that. So it can literally go, the hydrogen molecule can literally go through everything in your body and go right into the very DNA and repair it. First of all, you're repairing oxidative damage, but you're also reducing or eliminating free radicals. Now, we're only the bad free radicals, which is another reason why hydrogen is good, because you actually have free radicals in your body that you want to keep. Example, nitrous oxide.
The oxidative stress, is that the main thing that damages the DNA and causes the regeneration to stop, you know, youthing or getting older, immune organs? Is that at the base, George Weissman, of most of the issues?
It's one of the
just
bases,
one of them.
But this comes back to that regeneration thing that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The cells won't regenerate. You won't have stem cells and that sort of thing if you haven't got enough hydrogen.
And if our body is not generating enough hydrogen, we get dehydrated. Lack of hydrogen. The AquaCure machine, 10% off, promo code OneRadio. Use the promo code OneRadio, 10% off in our store, OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener supported, One Radio Network.
John Remington Graham is with us, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. So you talked about, Mr. Graham, about the currency wars. Let's speak a little bit on the as being the cause for Currency Act, rather. They didn't want the colonists to use their own money, and King George was controlling how much was out there.
Oh, it was the legislation was passed probably due to the influence of the East India Company, which had gained control of money and credit in Great Britain. That was the real problem. It was private interests gained control of money and credit
in Britain.
In Britain, and by the agitation and financing of the Civil War in the United States, private interests gained control over money and country credit in our country.
Yes.
But it's the same and now we look at the Bilderberg Group and Bill Gates and all of these people. Are they trying to destroy strong nation states and get control of money and credit throughout the world? And they want to have a one world banking currency and government, which they control from behind the scenes.
So,
just like the banking cartel on Wall Street controls
yes, sir.
The United States.
With that model, that would mean that this cartel, this Bilderberg and these people, in your opinion, they're going to want to expand the dollar's dominance or come up with a new one?
They'll want to come up, probably will eventually want to establish...
A new one?
A new one, yeah. I mean, they're talking about an Amerigo to replace the peso, Mexican peso, the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar.
Amerigo?
Yeah. They have the euro, the Amero.
Oh, the Amero. I thought that was long gone. You still think that's alive?
That's what they were trying to do. They'll figure it out one way or another. But first, we have to destabilize the United States, which is what they're trying to do right now. Control of the press. You understand that the death of George Floyd, in Minneapolis, was due to was apparently due to police misconduct. Although we don't know all the facts, that we know that the major news media of the United States reported the crime in such a way that a fair trial will never be possible. It's a nightmare for an honest prosecutor. Hmm. Even if he is guilty, they can't give him a fair trial, so they may have to dismiss the charge. But that was used as a pretext to burn hundreds of buildings in Minneapolis and then get the governor of Virginia to try to take down the statue of General Lee in Richmond. So, I mean, and we have riots and looting all over the country. That's all designed, all orchestrated by the press, and it's meant to destabilize the United States and destroy our country as a strong nation.
Fascinating. So what do you make about all of these Lincoln statues and Jeffersons and Robert E. Lee wanting to be taken down, changing the names? There must be a lot of money and power behind this.
There is. It's George Soros and Bill Gates and the Bilderberg Group is financing it all.
Hmm. And how do you know that?
Well, because I've looked at the facts over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you study American history, you can see that the Democratic Party, which I was active as a Democrat for many, many years.
Really?
During the bulk of my career, I was active in the Democratic Party. And, I mean, I quit when the party bosses expected me to prosecute innocent men against whom there was no probable cause. And I thought, well, if this is what it means to be a Democrat, I must be a Republican. And so I became a Republican after the mold of Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr., who was Minnesota's greatest statesman. He was an insurgent Republican who was very much like William Jennings Bryan. He wanted honest money and wanted to promote the middle class, and he wanted a foreign policy that minds her own business. He was opposed to American participation in the First World War as a belligerent party.
Lindbergh, so he did a lot of bringing awareness to the monetary system, did he not?
Well, yeah, he was Minnesota's great statesman on the money question. Of course, his good name was shattered during his life, but he was a great man. His son, the aviator Lindbergh, who was his son, knew his father was a great man and always paid tribute to his father as a great man. But he is not appreciated much today because not many people really understand the importance of the money question. It's hard to believe that the demand to take down the statue of General Lee, as if he were
racist,
a symbol of a racist.
Right.
That's just General Lee was an abolitionist.
He was.
Yes. I can mention that he was the South. Some years ago, I found that during the pre-bellum period in the United States, before the outbreak of the Civil War, the strongest secession movement was in New England, and the strongest abolition movement was in Virginia. The South had the strongest abolition movement. The North had the strongest secession movement. So what I began to ask, how is this so? And I, over a period of time, studied this question point by point and learned that the war was agitated by banking houses which got their war and they financed it in consideration for being installed on Wall Street and in control of banking and currency in the United States through corrupt legislation like the National Bank Act of 1864 and the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which really consolidated their control, and they've been in control ever since.
On the National Bank Act of 1864, did they have to get both houses of Congress and the president to sign off on that?
Yes, of course they did.
Did they? Okay.
Most people didn't really. The only thing they promised to finance the war. The reason why the South lost and the North won was that they financed the North with hard money, and which they had. They could finance the war with hard money, and they said, if you do this, we will give you the hard money. You can win the war, and they won the war, and so that's why this corrupt legislation was passed.
I see. So that's why the South had to create their own currency, right?
They had paper currency.
Paper
and
currency.
Once New Orleans fell in 1862, they couldn't collateralize their bonds with cotton, so they had an inflationary currency. And the only thing that Confederate currency is good for now, and Southern currency at wartime, is collectors.
Sure. So after, was it Andrew Jackson that won it in New Orleans?
No. You're bringing up something else.
Okay.
Andrew Jackson was in the War of 1812, and he also vetoed the bill to extend the second bank.
We're going to get to that, but
that's a whole other problem.
But let's go back to New Orleans. You had mentioned that after New Orleans,
in 1862, New Orleans fell to the Union fleet.
Okay.
And the South did its business through New Orleans in exporting cotton.
Okay.
Cotton was what they would use to collateralize their bonds, but once New Orleans was gone, they couldn't collateralize their bonds, so the only thing they could do is to print inflationary paper currency.
So they before that, when cotton was the collateral for the bonds, they could actually borrow money from people.
They could have borrowed money. In fact, there was a very strong faction in the South, headed by Alexander Stevens, the vice president, and Joseph Johnston, who was one of their greatest general, if it wasn't Lee himself. And they wanted to get cotton shipped to Europe and sold at a profit, and then put in deposit in specie-paying institutions, which could then provide the South with ironclad ships that would break the blockade. But since they couldn't collateralize their bonds, they couldn't borrow from these big banking houses, who then lent their money to the North, and the North had their only had the hard money, and the North was able to thereby finance the conquest of the Southern states. Once they did that and consolidated the Union from their banking cartel on Wall Street, they were able to control the whole country. So centralization of the United States as a result of the Civil War, because the financiers who financed the conquest of the South got control of money and credit as part of the consideration for their loans to the United States of hard money to finance the war.
So when you say hard money, yes, sir, you're talking about gold and silver.
That's right.
Right.
Mainly so, gold.
Mainly gold. Well, I want to go back, though, to New Orleans. I thought it was, wasn't it Andrew, what's his face, Jackson that came down to
New Orleans? That was the War of 1812.
That was the War of 1812. In 1814, he went down and to New Orleans, right?
Yeah. That was another mistake that most people make.
Okay.
People think that the war came to an end because of the Battle of New Orleans, where Andrew Jackson was in command. But actually, the war was brought to an end, and the Treaty of Ghent was stimulated by the activity of the Hartford Convention during the War of 1812, which threatened to secede from the Union if the war wasn't stopped.
Wow.
And that is why President Madison instructed American diplomats to make peace without any mention of, or satisfaction on impressment, and the war was brought to an end. But the war was started by reckless foreign policy of Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, Tom, isn't it interesting how the more and more you dig into it with people like you, that we find out the only thing new in this world is the history that we don't know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, wow.
Well, that's one of the things that Thomas Jefferson, when he was president, he sunk a treaty with Great Britain that would have renewed the Jay Treaty and made peace, but it kept peace going with Great Britain and Canada. New England at that time had a love affair with Canada, which was then French-speaking, and political bastion of French Canada, and what was New France. And there was a love affair between New England and New France. A lot of intermarriage, a lot of business. And when the War of 1812 came up, New England didn't want to be part of the war. And eventually New England met in the Hartford Convention in 1814 and threatened the government of the United States, if you draft an army for an invasion of Canada, we will secede from the Union. That is why James Madison told American diplomats to make peace with Great Britain in the Treaty of Ghent. After the treaty was signed by American diplomats and was before the U.S. Senate, there was the Battle of New Orleans. But that had nothing to do with why the war came.
Interesting. John Remington Graham. So let's talk a little bit about Jackson. I know that he ran on the platform and won, was it in the 1830s or so, Mr. Graham, to kick out the bankers?
Well, that's true. Andrew Jackson was an interesting guy. He became president because he happened to be in command of American troops in New Orleans in early January of 1815. That came after the Treaty of Ghent was signed by diplomats on both sides. And when he was president, they tried to extend the the charter of the Second Bank of the United States. And Jackson vetoed it and wrote a very famous and made a very and vetoed the bill, and in his behalf an excellent veto message was published, and Jackson's veto of the bank bill is a classic in American history, and Jackson wanted the bank bill to be finished because because it was a bank that was largely controlled by private interests and compromised elections of the United States. I mean, just think about today.
Mm-hmm.
Our elections are mainly controlled by the press, which are owned by banking houses on Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
which control our banking and credit through mm-hmm. the Federal Reserve Act.
Yes.
And that was the culmination of the consideration paid for financing the American Civil War.
Goes all the way back. So with Jackson, again, let's see. Was the War of 1812, in your research, opinion about the 20-year charter of the Federal Bank being renewed or not?
No, it's not. The reason for the War of 1812 was that Jefferson prevented the treaty it was a treaty with Great Britain that would have extended the Jay Treaty.
Okay.
He did that in 1809. That opened a breach of difficulties between the United States and Great Britain, and eventually was erupted as the War of 1812. Jefferson caused the War of 1812 with his reckless foreign policy.
So this Jay Treaty, what did Jefferson want to stop or end?
He wanted a war with Great Britain. I mean, he always wanted a war with Great Britain.
He just wanted a war. So
that's because he hated the British.
Okay.
He had a bigoted foreign policy. When he was Secretary of State under George Washington, he pushed for the United States to get involved in war against Great Britain, and Washington stopped it in his neutrality proclamation and in his farewell address. The War of 1812 was started by Jefferson, who departed from the policy of George Washington when he was president.
So the argument, the War of 1812 was the charter of the central bank.
Nothing to do with
it. Had nothing to do, but it was at that same time. So that was just a.
No, it was later. The charter of the Second Bank was, the Second Bank of the United States was established, I think, in 1816, after the War of 1812.
Oh no! It was 17? Wasn't 1792? Was it one charter? Wasn't 20 years in 1812?
No. It was 1816.
1816. So
it was after the war that the Second Bank was established.
Right. Okay.
But and then when Jefferson became the man from Tennessee, Jackson became president, there was a bill before Congress to extend the charter of the Second Bank. Jackson then vetoed that in 1832.
Okay. And when was that charter to be up? They did 20 years at that time, correct?
Right, at that time. Of course, now we don't have those limitations.
Sure. So there must have been a war. Well, again, that's 1812 times 20 is 32.
No, you're wrong.
No?
It was the Second Bank ran out in 1836, but the bill to extend the charter of the bank came up in 1832.
Gotcha.
And Jackson was.
Well, and can't it be argued then that the bill to extend the bank came up in 1812?
No, it didn't come up in 1812. It was because the Second Bank didn't exist. The Second Bank was not reestablished until 1816. We lived for about 4 years without a
central
bank. Washington, a central bank in the United States might have been a good idea along lines proposed by Alexander Hamilton, who did not want a central bank controlled by private interests.
Right.
The evil was central bank by private interests. If we had a central bank that was publicly owned and controlled and regulated, it might be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is privately controlled, private interests control it behind the scenes and run it for their own convenience, that's what's the problem.
Yes, sir.
So Thomas Jefferson takes all the credit when, in fact, he was at fault. Alexander Hamilton takes all the blame when he was the one who was right.
Hamilton, right. Yeah, he's always painted as the bad guy.
Yeah, well, he isn't the bad guy.
He isn't. So when we're doing our hot dogs and apple pie and beer on Saturday for 4th of July, who, in your opinion, should be our heroes?
Alexander Hamilton.
Hamilton. That's the opposite
of
what
George Washington. Alexander Hamilton defended George Washington's attempt to prevent Jefferson from getting us
into
war with Great Britain in favor of France in 1893.
Let's go back to
1793.
Let's go back to Andrew Jackson. So he is running for president. The charter for the central bank is going to be coming up, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And Jackson vetoed the bill to extend the charter of the second bank before the second bank actually expired. But it was, you know, they one of the limitations they wanted on a central bank was a charter of 20 years.
Yes.
In those days. Now we don't have that anymore. Although we have something else that might surprise you.
Well, we'll ask you about that. So he vetoed the bill. So
to extend the charter,
right? So then, where was the central bank? Where was it positioned when Jackson did that?
Where was the position?
I mean, if he vetoed the bill to extend.
I sound like Joe Biden. The difference between Joe Biden and me is that I know I shouldn't be running for president.
That's hilarious. No, that's all right. No, that's all right. It gets a little geeky here. You're doing good. So after he vetoed the bill to extend the charter, what was the central bank? Where was it?
There wasn't a central
there
bank.
There wasn't any. Wow.
And what we got was something new by the National Bank Act of 1864 to replace the old second bank. And that allowed establishment of national banks, which had special privileges.
Yes, sir. Okay.
But
so
to finance that, you had to have war bonds.
Right. But between Jackson and 1864, where did the people's money from taxes get put?
U.S. Treasury.
U.S. Treasury. Wow. That would be the place to do it today if you could, right?
That would be, you could make the U.S. Treasury a national bank if you wanted, but it would have to be, the problem here is that we need to have public monetary authority. It has to be controlled by public interests. It has to be transparent. It has to be publicly regulated.
Mm-hmm.
If it is privately owned and controlled, like the Federal Reserve, it's not a good thing for the country. What they do is their press. I mean, what was the interesting thing about the 2016 election? Wasn't that Trump won? It was that the New York Times lost.
That's why he's always dogging the New York Times.
Well, the New York Times is the flagship of the major media of the United States, owned and controlled by the interests which own and control the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's been so ever since the American Civil War.
Wow. All the news that's fit to print, they say.
Yeah, I mean, so that's why they hate Trump so bad. And they may have succeeded. He may not be reelected. Well, that would be a terrible, that would be the end of the United States. But most people don't know that. You know, and not because Trump is perfect, but because because the Democrats can't put up anybody that who's credible. I mean, can you imagine Joe Biden, who is flaky from age like me? he's flaky from age like me, being taking orders from Kamala Harris and who was that gal from Minneapolis? I forget her name. Amy Klobuchar.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have our country. We'll, and then we have Antifa and Black Lives Matter burning down buildings in our big cities. I mean, it would destroy the United States as a major power. Which is fine, because the Bilderberg Group wants to destroy nation states and replace it with a one-world government, an EU-style one-world government, which they own and control behind the scenes. That's what this is all about. And they're trying to make Robert E. Lee look like a symbol of racism. Robert E. Lee was an abolitionist.
Yes, sir. You said that. So this idea of COVID, the finances, the Black Lives Matter, and
COVID is part of it. Yes,
sir. So it's all part of the same. You're arguing it's all part of the same push to destabilize the country.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's what they always do. I mean, they did it in Great Britain. I mean, it may very well have been that the Currency Acts, which eventually triggered the American Revolution, came from the East India Company, which was the form of private financiers in those days. That was established with a charter granted by Queen Elizabeth I in 1599.
You've mentioned the East India Company several times. What's the story on this one?
Well, the East India Company was a group of private financiers, mm-hmm. who got a charter, mm-hmm. from Queen Elizabeth I,
mm-hmm.
to export silver to India.
Export silver?
To India, and then bring back gold, because in India the mint price of silver was 9 or 10 to 1. And under the sterling standard in England, it was 15.21 to 1. So they could export silver to India, exchange it for gold, and then bring back the gold as a profit. And then this happened throughout the 17th century. It plays a very interesting role in the history of England. But the East India Company thereby gained control over, they got control of the Bank of England, which was their Federal Reserve, and it was a public bank, mm-hmm. in form, but in reality it was a privately owned and controlled bank, which controlled money and credit. It almost bankrupted the British Empire. It got them to adopt measures which eventually provoked the American Revolution. And I mean, the United States might have gotten their independence anyway, as did Canada, without a revolution. But the Bank of England stimulated the Currency Acts, which promoted the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But all these details are largely hidden to most Americans and most Canadians.
Well, it sure have been hidden to me.
I'm approaching 80, and now I know, and I realize that most people don't know, and I wonder why. I can see it, but it may not. It may be too late to do anything about it. I don't know. I pray the rosary every day and ask. Somehow or other, the that we are saved by the grace of God. But, and I, late in my life, I'm beginning to understand all of this. But I don't know whether these delusions are too strong. I trust that God will, in His watch care, mm-hmm. save our country.
Mm, very interesting. Well, as you know, I mean, it's very complicated, intertwined, inextricably all tied together, and it takes people that really want to understand and know the truth. And most Americans they're not intellectually able to even do that right now because they're just so scared and worried. And
we there's a saying, we get too soon out and too late smart.
What's too, say it again?
We get too soon out and too late smart.
What's the word too soon? What's the next word? I'm missing that.
Old.
Oh. Too soon, yeah. Old, and
old too, and too late smart.
Too late smart. That's, I like that one. Here's an email for you, Mr. Graham. I didn't hear the beginning of the show, but do you feel that they're afraid that President Trump is going to expose the total corruption of our government? They, I guess, are meaning.
Well, I think that's one thing that they want to. I think that they want to get Trump because, If he is president for another 4 years, he may very well expose the internal corruption in the government of the United States, including its control by a banking cartel on Wall Street through their control of money and credit. That may be one reason that they certainly want to destroy Trump for that reason. And they want to destroy Trump for the other reason, that he wants strong nation states.
Mm, that's the big one, isn't it?
That's a big one. Both of them are important.
Sure.
This gentleman who raised this point, if he exposes the corruption in our government, that would certainly not, that would open the door toward a whole new history in getting rid of the fact that we are a country controlled by private interests through their control of banking and currency and money and credit.
Yes, sir.
And the major news media, of which the New York Times and Associated is a flagship with Associated Media.
So if they're concerned that he would go for the real juggernaut in the Federal Reserve and that whole thing, that would be like too much to take, right? I mean,
phew. Well, that's right. And yeah. Certainly Ooh. He's
alluded to it a bit, right? Hasn't he?
He's rattled a sword about the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
But any American who has really studied this deeply knows.
Yes.
That what I'm saying is true. I'm not.
No, I understand. No.
I'm getting old now, and I may not be. It may be too old to correct anything. But at least I understand. You know.
Yes. Well.
But a lot of Americans understand this.
Do you think?
We're just not that many of us, in relation to the whole population of the country.
I would think if you went out and just did a survey on video and say, do you think the Federal Reserve is government or private? I would think most Americans, 9 out of 10 people, would say government, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would.
Yeah, they would.
But there have been statesmen in our country who have known otherwise, like Charles Lindbergh,
yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Who opposed the Federal Reserve to the last vote in Congress, and Congressman Louis McFadden of Pennsylvania,
McFadden, right,
who was a small-town banker and then became chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, the House Banking and Currency Committee.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to explain the stock market crash in 1829, or 1929, and the origin of the Second World War through the corruption of the peace treaty at Versailles in 1919 that brought the war to an end artlessly. I mean, there have been great statesmen in American history who have understood the money question, including Congressman Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, right? Yes, sir.
And you know, and it's there have been a number of these characters. The story seems to be that they all suffer a lot.
Yes, sir. We've heard some. Not sure about who was the fellow in '92 that they edged out. You know who I mean? The banker. Not that banker, but the business guy that Ross Perot.
And Ross Perot, yes.
We've heard some stories from their Texas delegation over the years that they got pretty
Ross
rough.
Ross Perot was certainly a wonderful American, but and as though he had a huge fortune, and he tried his best to wager, and he did a good job. Of course, I voted for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a great guy. You know, it's interesting, though, if you take a look at these guys who understand the money question, Charles Lindbergh Sr., Louis McFadden, Ross Perot, and others, they don't always have the same solution. For example, Ron Paul believes in a gold dollar. Lindbergh was opposed to a gold dollar. He wanted to stop minting gold dollars. But Ross Perot believes that our monetary system should be based on gold, as did Louis McFadden.
Yes, sir.
So, but I mean, I don't think the solution is just going back to gold and silver. I think it's more complicated than that.
Of course.
The people who understand the money system and the money question do not all agree on how to solve the problem.
Yes, sir. Well, I think that even with 8,000 alleged, we don't know, tons of gold and $25 trillion, the math doesn't work. I mean, to go gold back fully, it would be 50,000 an ounce for gold.
Well,
we could do a fraction, though, right?
I think Benjamin Franklin illustrated you can have a very successful paper money system disciplined by something other than gold or silver.
Mm-hmm. What would it be disciplined by? GDP?
Benjamin Franklin proposed a system where the discipline was land mortgages.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. His system was called coined land.
Coined land.
And before the American Revolution, it was a publicly controlled and regulated system of paper money disciplined by land mortgages. But because it was publicly controlled and regulated and carefully watched, it was a successful system. And
how did that work? Let me interrupt. How did that work? That's interesting. How did that land?
Well, I can tell you basically that...
Okay.
He proposed that Pennsylvania issue paper currency, legal tender, and to run the operations of government. And to run the operations of government, and then you do it on tax. With taxes, you. You pay back you withdraw that currency from circulation so it doesn't inflate.
Right.
But then he said, "We will lend the state of Pennsylvania will lend currency into circulation in consideration of land mortgages. The land mortgages being the discipline.
Yes.
And that will be paid back." At moderate interest and then lent back into circulation. So the main bulk of the money was the state of Pennsylvania lending paper currency called legal tender by the government in consideration of land mortgages. And as the repayment of these mortgages continued, new money would be lent into circulation.
So let me walk through it a second. So
public spending, which was then on dedicated tax revenue.
Right. So let me walk through it a second. I'm in Pennsylvania. What year was this, Mr. Graham?
Well, these were in before the American Revolution.
Wow.
I think in the early 18th century.
Okay, before 1776.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so here's Pennsylvania. I'm a guy. I want to buy...
And Philadelphia was the second city of the British Empire.
Yes, sir. Yes. So I want to buy 10 acres of land. I go to this to the bank that they established. They create enough money to me give to buy the land, right? And then I pay back that money to them. And then what happens from there?
When that deflates the payment back. All the money, all the profits from the lending become government revenue.
Yes.
It reduces the need for taxes.
Oh, okay. So they're going to charge me interest for this, even though they created the money.
Yes.
And then the taxes on...
But now it's the same thing we have today, except that it's created by privatism.
Yes, right. So if we want to buy a $400,000 home, we can go to Wells Fargo, and they literally create the $400,000.
Yes, they create it, and we pay them back with interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The only reason why it's legal tender is that we say it's legal.
That's right. So back in Pennsylvania, did they then tax my 10 acres to suck some of that money out to curb inflation?
No, they didn't
they
have
didn't.
The inflation was curbed by paying back the loans.
Paying back the loans.
To
the government that created the money.
Yeah, the government created the money and just called it legal tender and said, here.
Okay.
And then you pay them back, and that deflates the currency. But you calculate how much money you need to keep the country in good, have an optimum supply of money and credit. Mm-hmm. And they lent or spent money into circulation. But it was always the government that did this, and it was always regulated
and
transparent and audited. And all, so or anybody who wanted to know what was going on, you couldn't create a crisis secret manipulation of the money supply.
Fascinating. So could this be done today just in a wave of magic wand and say, well, the Treasury has this bank, and they could then loan Patrick.
In theory, yes. Yeah. Although you would have to, it would take some.
Sure. Yeah.
Some technical. Some doing,
but you could do it.
Yes, we could.
You could do it, and then people pay back their mortgages, and that would keep that liquid.
Yes.
It would keep it liquid, and what would keep inflation at bay if you're creating this money for these?
Well, you don't get a loan unless you have a mortgage land to
do it. Mortgage. Okay, all right.
See, Pennsylvania didn't have any gold and silver, but it had lots of land.
Ah, okay.
And land is a very good, and according to Franklin, is a very good way to measure wealth.
Mm-hmm. Was Benjamin Franklin a good guy? One of us?
Yes. Well, he was George Washington and Benjamin Franklin.
Hmm.
Although the Revolution had a very dubious beginning, George Washington and Benjamin Franklin seized control of the Revolution. And that's why the American Revolution was a success.
What did they do, seize control?
Well, I mean, Washington commanded the army, and Franklin commanded the statesmanship. He was the one who negotiated the treaty with France in 1778, and the one who negotiated independence from Britain in 1783.
Hmm.
And Franklin and Washington was the president of the Philadelphia Convention, which framed our Constitution. And Franklin was the primary diplomat who steered the convention away from disaster and directed it in a good, in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. John Remington Graham is with us. We're about finished here, but we're going to do one quick break, Mr. Graham, and then wrap it up with a few other questions, okay?
All right.
Stay
good.
Right there. This is fun. Don't you love talking to folks like this? Man, I sure do. Whew.
Brian Clement, who heads up the Hippocrates Institute in Florida,
talked about saunas here. Elke writes in for Brian Clements. Would Brian give us some tips on what supplements we would need to take if we do saunas several times a week to replenish lost minerals from sweating?
Well, Dr. Rao, who you had on, is a colleague and a friend. We do often conferences together in Europe, and I agree. We have saunas here. I take a sauna, so you know this, no matter where I travel in the world, 365 days a year. I think it's mandatory.
Really?
87%, listen closely, okay. 87% more heavy metals and chemicals come out in an infrared.
Well, no wonder we feel better when we take these saunas. We have the Relax Far Infrared Sauna we've talked about on sale through August, $950 delivered. Okay, forget that one, Patrick. That's a kind of a older spot that we talk about the sauna. We have an ongoing price. Now, they went up in January since 6 months ago, but people love them. They're a great value at $1,150. That's the price. You go around Google's and anywhere, and you're not going to get anything close to that. So they have allowed us to do this price because we are willing to take less commission, and I'd rather have more out there. And it's just, you make it up by volume. You know, just make it up by volume. So if you'd like to get one of these saunas, email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So if you live in the lower 48 states, just rock and roll, $1,150. Anywhere else around the world, we have listeners all over the world. We can take care of you, and just send me your address, and I'll give you the exact cost for the sauna, no matter where you live. We've shipped them to South Korea, shipped them Japan, Australia, everywhere. And it's not as much as you think to get it, and it'll come with the proper plug, and the proper plug and voltage for your country. Just email me, and we'll do it, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We're talking with health motivator Daniel Vitalis about testosterone and pine pollen. Some of the guys have asked if taking pine pollen would dampen their own testosterone production.
Well, that's something that can happen with the steroidal forms of isolated bioidentical testosterone. And that's one of the issues bodybuilders who are taking steroids often have. What I want to point out about pine pollen is that it's a whole food, and the amount of testosterone that's present is very rarefied. So these aren't really issues that we experience when we take the whole food form of pine pollen or a tincture of pine pollen, but it is an issue if people are taking synthetic testosterone.
Pine pollen. It's a whole food. It's real. And it works for you girls, too. Click and order on any of the Surthrival links. Exquisitely manufactured, only from Daniel Vitalis and Surthrival, on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com. Once again, here's Patrick. Know the source. One Radio Network.
Okay, John Remington Graham. And if you'd like to pick up his book on the money and the Federal Reserve and the Civil War, Mr. Graham, that's called Blood Money.
Blood Money.
And
Blood
that's
Money, the Civil War and the Federal Reserve. It's published in the second edition by Turning the Tide Publishing. And you can either Google that and order it right online, or you can call the publisher himself at 850-677-0344.
Turning the Tide Publishing, 850-677-0344. So if you're homeschooling, this would be a nice book rather than the curriculum they teach you at public school about... Well, wow. You said that there was a surprise about, what was it, the Federal Reserve Act?
Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve Act,
yeah,
has a provision that was in the original Act of 1813 and was renumbered Section 31 in 1978. This provision allows Congress to repeal the act and abolish the Federal Reserve without any claim that it expressly says that this act may be repealed and reserved at any time. Without, there isn't any claim that there is a contract that the government of the United States has to honor. Congress can get rid of the Federal Reserve by simple legislation.
Interesting. So that the 1913 Federal Reserve Act
removes all constitutional questions. And this provision, which is Section 31 of the Federal Reserve Act as amended in 1978,
mm-hmm.
Or Section 30 of the original Federal Reserve Act of 1913,
mm-hmm.
All we have to do is find out the facts and act according to the information we have and repeal the act, and can set up a new central banking system
owned by
that's publicly controlled and owned
by the Treasury. So, who was behind the 1978 introduction of Section 31 that says we can repeal this baby whenever we want?
That was in the original act.
Oh, it was in there.
78 merely renumbered this.
They just renumbered it.
It was Section 30. Now it's Section 31.
I see. But okay.
It's part of the Federal Reserve Act.
I see. So, but can it be argued to play, you know, as an attorney here on the other side, can it be argued that there's so much control of congressmen and senators that by the bankers that would be a tough one to get in? Right?
That might be that the problem is political, not legal.
Of course, yeah, yeah. What kind of how do they get
that,
this?
That's what you're saying. The problem is political. I mean, everybody in Congress is owned. You know,
how do they do that?
Well, over time they foster ignorance and create fear. And one cannot, if one stood up and said we ought to use Section 31 of the Federal Reserve Act as amended in 1978,
mm-hmm.
get rid of the Federal Reserve, he might find life very difficult.
Yes, sir. I understand. That's really poking the giant in the eye.
It's interesting that this provision is no longer in the United States Code. It has been deliberately edited out, but
it exists.
It is part of the United States statutes at large. It's part of the law.
Would that be a simple majority in both houses?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Wow.
If we woke up to the reality that the Federal Reserve is owned and controlled by private interests, which in turn own and control the press, which exist only to shape public opinion and swing elections, we realize that our destiny as a nation is in the hands of these private interests, and we abolished the Federal Reserve and took control of our country again. We could do it just by simple legislation.
Yes, sir.
And everything is being done first to hide the fact that could happen, simply by editing Section 31 out of the United States Code, things of that sort, or we could set up a new central banking system that would be in the control of public authority, audited, transparent, and carefully regulated, so that the abuses we now see in our national life will not exist anymore.
But we would have to create these dollars in that central bank from Treasury, and isn't that illegal?
No, it isn't. The problem is that the Federal Reserve Act, the Constitution allows only gold and silver coins
yes,
to the tender.
Yes.
But the Supreme Court, in their bungling way, held that Congress can issue legal tender currency that is paper.
When was that?
They did that in 1882 or 1883. It's called Juilliard versus Greenman was the case.
Juilliard versus Greenman?
Greenman, right.
And they said that Congress can go ahead and do a specie or currency or whatever.
Could issue paper currency, make it legal tender.
Because before that, they were really unconstitutional. Well, no, okay, I got
but
you.
But that is contrary to the intended meaning of the United States.
Yes, sir. Article 1, Section 8.
But, you know, I mean, the point, you know, if I'm not saying that the original Constitution is ultimate truth. There's no reason why we can't amend the Constitution. During the Civil War, the North couldn't fight the war without issuing legal tender paper currency, because the cost of the war was so enormous, they couldn't fight the war unless. So they just illegally issued U.S. notes to pay for the war.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing. One of the casualties that came from the war. It was a terrible mistake. I mean, we're supposed to love Lincoln, who got us into the worst war in American history in only 39 days in office. So I don't know why we should worship him for that.
Why was Kennedy, the story is that Kennedy created silver certificates, I think 300 million. Why was he able to do that legally, or was it illegal?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, you don't know?
I don't have the answer, but I know that he did something like that.
Yes.
He did it by executive order, and it may have been on the basis of existing statutes. There is a theory that says that Kennedy was murdered because he did that.
Yes.
I don't think so. I think he was murdered because he decided that the Vietnam War was not a winnable war, and the powers of high finance wanted that war, and so he was murdered.
Probably for a lot of reasons.
But certainly that, I think the main reason was that he wanted to pull out of Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah. People argue, too, that he wanted to bust up the CIA. Remember his quote?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think the best book on Kennedy's death anywhere was written by... it's called Who Really Killed Kennedy, and it was written by I'm trying to think of the guy's name, Jerry Corsi.
Jerome Corsi, yeah.
Jerome Corsi's book is very good because it was written after with 50 years of hindsight.
Yes.
Corsi himself is well educated, with a PhD from Harvard, and I think it's political science or history, I can't remember which, but same thing. And he has read everything that's ever been written about Kennedy's death. And so it's a very good book. And he endorses the view that this is an inside job, the CIA and the FBI and organized crime. And it was mainly... he was murdered mainly because he decided to get out of Vietnam on advice of Ambassador George F. Kennedy and General James Gavin.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there not other presidents that were allegedly shot at or killed? McKinley, Garfield for messing with the banks? McKinley.
Well, I mean, it's there. You're asking. It's a huge question.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to answer it, but I would certainly say that private control of our money and credit by one means or another is a very bad proposition and gives private interests control over the destiny of our country, which is not in the public interest.
Why couldn't President Trump just declare a national emergency, GDP, whatever you want to say, and just send in the army and take over the Fed?
Well, because it would be illegal.
I know.
And he's got enough problems.
I know it would be illegal.
I mean, I remember when I was county attorney, and there were people who saw all this corruption in the courthouse. I mean, I had the sheriff and the chief of police and the county board and everybody in the cocaine business, and they said, why don't you charge him? Well, because I have to live with political reality. That's why.
Yeah.
And even Kennedy, Trump has to live with political reality, and I think he understands that.
Well, you would have to.
I don't
to
know how much longer he's going to be president for another couple
boy,
of months.
Yeah, boy, the way it's going, boy.
And it don't know. We don't really know.
Yeah, and it sure looks like the people who are controlling this whole coronavirus meme are not going to let it go. I mean, we see things happening that are just, if you really understand as I do, I believe, are just incorrect and false with the testing and how many cases.
Well, there's no question that there's been a tremendous amount of falsehood about the coronavirus.
Yes, sir. You see that? Are you?
My career was very largely in forensic science and medicine.
Oh, it was? Oh.
Oh, yes. And I tried a lot of cases mathematical statistics and epidemiology, and I mean this stuff is very, and I know that the global warming scare and the coronavirus scare are news media creations, and that there's a lot of falsehood going out there. One reason why Trump has to be very careful is that he doesn't have unlimited power. And if he tried to say, you know, it's like asking me, why don't you charge these people? Well, because I have to live with reality, that's why.
Yeah, you're right in the belly of the beast. Finally, I wanted to ask, we talk about the media, and I think it can be argued that whoever these people are, that they really do control and have. Did you know how far back it went, Mr. Graham, of when the money people started getting controlling the media? How long ago?
I think that it all began with the financing of the American Civil War, which is what my book is about. Mm-hmm.
Back then, that's when they started to buy newspapers and.
Yeah, they bought. You first, you get control of the money supply, and then you buy up newspapers and news media.
And now it's deep.
So what? And then you tell. For example, you say the reason why they convince everybody that democracy is so wonderful is because if you have control of the press, you can swing 10% of the vote in any election. Usually,
I would think it'd be even
control 10%. If you can swing 10% of the vote in any election, you don't have to control the whole country. You just. If you could
10%.
10% is plenty.
Well, there sure are a lot of forces out here selling this vote by mail thing, isn't there? Who?
Oh, sure.
Oh, it's huge, right?
Yeah.
You think that's dangerous?
Well, of course it is.
That was a soft.
Because it opens the door. But liberals they don't give it. They care not about the integrity of our elections.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Graham, what a pleasure having you here.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I'm sorry I don't have the universal knowledge that you would like me to have.
Oh no, you're doing. It was great. We did.
I think ending the private control of our money and credit would go a long way.
The big thing, right? That's the big one. The juggernaut. Yeah. All right, sir. What are you going to do fun this weekend for 4th of July? You have family?
Yeah, sure. I'm right now speaking on the 1st of July, which is Canada Day.
Oh, it's Canada
Day. The day in which the British North America Act of 1867 went into effect when Queen Victoria was on the throne. So,
does the Queen still have control of you guys up there in Canada, like people say?
Well, I mean, the Queen is represented by the Governor General. The Governor General, in theory, has a lot of power, but her control is limited by constitutional conventions.
Mm-hmm.
There's unwritten principles of constitutional law, which means that she doesn't have as much power as she's mainly a ceremonial magistrate.
Well, we appreciate all of your time this morning. You did great, and thank you so much. And all the best to you and your family, and we'll stay in touch, Mr. Graham.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, been a pleasure. John Remington Graham, 80 years old, 50 years as attorney and prosecutor, and did cases, and wow. Pretty fun, huh? Man, I love talking to folks like that. Okay, kids, we're going to take a day off, and then we're going to do a 4th of July show. And I don't know what that's going to be, but that'll be on Friday, Open Phone Friday. Thank you for your ongoing support. I got a few more days of the colostrum sale with Sothrival. The sulfur sale is over. Thanks for participating in that. Sold a lot of sulfur. That was quite fun. So be careful, you know, of how crazy you get about all the silly things going on. We're here to try to help all of us stay more grounded and not get really goofy over the world. It's a great, you know, just to realize that it's just a movie, but it's fun to look at it. So we're here to support you in any way that we can. My email is patrick@oneradionetwork.com, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So I love you all very much. Thanks a lot. We'll see you on Friday, Open Phone Friday, and may the blessings be.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.